Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 8, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm out of town right now celebrating my sister-in-law's college graduation, so I'm coming to you on recording. Tonight, something a little off the beaten track, at least for this program, an interview with the composer, musician, and music historian Ned Sublett. Ned has a variety of talents, from working with Glenn Branca in the downtown Manhattan music scene of the late 70s and early 80s, to developing his own punk salsa and cowboy rumba hybrids, to researching the histories of salsa, rumba, and New Orleans music. In part, this is a chance for me to let my repressed inner music programmer out of the closet for an hour, but it's also the first installment of what I hope will be a series of programs looking at the relationships between politics and culture. They're often seen, even at this radio station, where we're not supposed to respect conventional distinctions, as two entirely separate spheres. They're not. So instead of reading you some economic headlines, which would be stale by the time you hear this anyway, let's hear the first 2 minutes of the opening track from Ned's 1999 CD, Cowboy Rumba, Ghost Riders in the Sky. A bit of Ghost Riders in the Sky, a song written by Stan Jones and performed by Ned Sublett and a group of mainly New York-based Latino musicians. Before we get to the interview, let me announce two of his appearances coming up. He'll be reading from a book in progress about Louisiana, along with four other writers at the BAM All-Stars Reading Series at The Kitchen, 512 West 19th Street, June 14th at 7 p.m. And he'll be playing a solo acoustic gig at the Bowery Poetry Club, Bowery and Bleecker, Wednesday, June 28th, 8 p.m. sharp. I'll mention these again at the end of the program. Okay, let's get right to the interview, which I recorded last Sunday. Ned Sublett. Listening to your voice, it doesn't sound like you're from New York City. How'd you end up here?
Well, I do have a curious accent, but it's not an accent from one place. It's a kind of a composite. I have a drawl and a twang. I was born in Lubbock, Texas, but until I was 9, I lived in Natchitoches, Louisiana, where the people have a sort of broad drawl. Then we moved to El Paso for a year into eastern New Mexico, which is very close to Lubbock, where I was born. Lubbock was kind of the center of my childhood. My grandma lived there. And I had a real strong West Texas thing in my voice. But depending on who I'm talking to, one or the other side of it may pop out more. I wound up in New York City because it was seemed like the one place where I might be able to make a living as a musician. And this was back in, well, I moved here on my 25th birthday, July 8th, 1976. And I have to say, as I look back on my life, one decision I'm very happy I made was to spend the last 30 years in New York City, because it's just been wonderful.
Well, and you've succeeded in making a living as a musician.
I don't know if I did. I don't know if I did. You know, I succeeded in surviving. You know, I did a lot of other things and abused a lot of credit cards on the way, but I'm still standing, so I guess I did.
Your first days in New York music were kind of with the downtown art noise scene?
Well, it took... Well, we never... I don't think anybody who was part of it ever called it the art noise scene, you know. I think... the word art was a very polemical word in those days, especially from, you know, there's a sort of a music critic populism which liked to use the word art. It was this curious manifestation of I think, a kind of anti-intellectualism in our culture that was very much part of the polemics of music in the 70s. But we never thought of it as art music. I came here in 1976, and it took me a while to find my place. But, you know, I was drawn to what was happening downtown. And I had a lot of friends who were composers. I have a master's degree in music. I trained as a composer. And I was trying to, at first, I was trying to do a kind of music that didn't have to take place in bars and nightclubs. You know, yeah, right. Of course, it's been a long time since I played in anything but a bar or a nightclub, or in a long time since I've gone anywhere to hear music but a bar or a nightclub. So that's left back 30 years ago where it belonged, I guess. But in started my own band in 1982 to play in clubs. The idea of having a band was as a foil for my songwriting. And I always tried to get the best musicians I could. And it started, the first show was at CBGB's in 1982. And over the years, as I had the band, it sort of evolved a step at a time from being a dissonant country band to being a salsa band, because that was just where my head was going. At some point, really, I think it was about 1985, I had a salsa conversion experience.
I want to get back to that, but 1976, the late 70s, early 80s were a very different time for people trying to do music or art or anything outside Wall Street. 82, when the bull market took off, really the city started changing. So how's the experience of being a musician in New York City must be very different today from what it was in the wake of the fiscal crisis, when rents were really low and it looked like the city was on its back.
It was a very exciting time to be here when the city was bankrupt. That was when New York was at its most creative. No question. You could find a place to live. There was a downtown community. Look at all the stuff that was happening in New York in the late 70s. You had the salsa boom. That was the great period of funk. You had, you know, hip hop was just getting started uptown. Downtown, there was punk rock. There was the kitchen scene, which was more or less what I was part of. What am I leaving out? You had it was just a very creative time in this town.
Have we managed to survive culturally with the influx of hedge fund money?
I think it's a lot less interesting town culturally than it used to be. Least in Manhattan, you know, I think it's moved out more to the peripheries, and it's split off more. Manhattan in those days was this kind of fascinating melting pot for music, because you could have people who lived here and played here, and there were venues to play at and places to live.
We have to wish for a return of bankruptcy to get a cultural renaissance here.
Well, often it seems like that's when you have moments of creativity.
So tell us about your salsa conversion. What happened to you in the mid-80s?
Really, you know, I was trained to be ready for the music. I was a classical guitarist. I spoken Spanish since I was a child. I learned guitar from a Cuban who taught me in Spanish in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I had pretty much, in retrospect, the strange thing is what took me so long to tune in. Why did it take me almost 10 years to find my spot in the audience at salsa shows? I don't know. But once it happened, I realized this music was it was just the best music in town, period. I mean, it had enormously high level of musicianship. You'd walk into the Village Gate on Monday night for those legendary jams, and there'd be, you know, seven really good trombone players standing at the bar. And the music did for me what, when I was a kid, rock and roll did for me, but had long since stopped doing. It excited me physically, kinetically, made me want to move. And at the same time, it satisfied me intellectually, because Latin popular music is a very erudite and intellectual music. It had the elaboration of composition, because there are, you know, the charts are very well thought through, very through composed, and it had the stretch out and jam feeling of, that you get at the montuno, that you get when the singer starts to improvise, when the soloists start to hold forth. So it had this wonderful combination of structure and flexibility, understood by everybody, and people danced, and people dressed up nice to go out. And it was just...
Those folks at CBGB's.
It was really nice to see people dressed up to go out for a good time instead of looking as grody as they could. I have to say, I enjoyed it. But really, it was the quality of the music. And
well, what's the origin
to this day, it still fascinates me.
What's the origin of salsa?
Basically, you know, that, there's a polemic there, but I think we can safely say that the musical roots of it are in Cuba. What makes it so interesting, however, is that in New York, it became a more polyglot thing. And by the time the term salsa began to be applied to it in the 70s, of course, we had, you know, contact with Cuba had long since ceased. Most of the key players of the salsa boom were, of course, Puerto Rican. And it became a statement of Puerto Rican identity. So there was a very fascinating thing going on. There's no band in New York that's all one nationality in the Latin world. I mean, you know, you don't have, and there hasn't been. I mean, throughout the 20th century, you know, there's it's rare to see a band that's all Cubans or all Puerto Ricans, or, you know, the timbalero might be Venezuelan, the horn players might be Jewish, the piano player might be Panamanian, you know, you have a Dominican bass player, whatever. There's a sort of a pan-Latin thing that happens here, but the roots are largely Cuban, and the key players are Puerto Rican.
And so you took your first trip to Cuba? When?
And I might add one more thing about that. And the singers, you know, the Puerto Rico has been, I think Puerto Rico is one of the most underappreciated cultural resources that New York has drawn on for the last century, and especially as an incubator of singers. The singers who come up from Puerto Rico, my God, and they're still coming up. Anyway, to answer your question, it was precisely after having had this experience of hearing this, the gods were walking the earth every Monday night at the Village Gate, and there was no book to explain this. There was not, I mean, the hip music writers barely touched it. It was just this fascinating thing that was going on within pretty much its own culture. In order to understand what it was about, I felt like I would never understand it fully if I didn't go to Cuba. And I did. In January 1990, made my first trip to Cuba, and I made 25 trips to Cuba.
I'm speaking with Ned Sublett, the musician and music historian. Let's talk a bit about Cuba. There's a lot of, you know, the standard image of Cuba in the United States is that it's a miserably grim and repressed place. And I think there are even some people on the American left who would share some of that prejudice. That is obviously not what you discovered.
Well, it's a complicated place. It has a grim aspect. It has a repressed aspect. There are a lot of problems in Cuba, but if you look at the propaganda, you know, you might think that people are just shuffling down the street with their feet in chains weeping in Cuba, and that's not at all what I found. You know, you find people laughing, you find them taking wonderful care of each other, and you find a lot of music and a lot of dance. Now, just because people are dancing doesn't mean they're happy. It's more complex than that. It means that's how they live. It means the music, you know, Cuba was surviving on music when it almost didn't have anything else to keep going on. Music was such an important part of keeping the Cuban morale up. And in the period before I got there, I could really see this, that this had happened. When I got there in 1990, there was this style already pretty fully developed that would, some years later, become known as timba, which was The Cubans were still calling it salsa, really, but it didn't sound a whole lot like the salsa that was being played in New York. It had evolved along another path. And this
were they open to outside influences, or is it very much an insular scene?
Well, very much open to outside influences, but communication is... That whole picture changed a lot over the years. In the 90s, there was a big cultural opening. A lot of Cuban musicians got the opportunity to travel more. Some had, you know, the best-known ones had been traveling all along to Europe. In the 90s, Cuban musicians began to be able to come and play in New York, and it, as you may recall, by the late 90s, it had become very common to see Cuban bands playing in New York clubs, which was an absolutely amazing moment, both in terms of what it meant for Cuban music and what it meant for Latin music in New York. There was a real exchange of ideas and of almost like family feeling going on. People, it was almost like what things would be like if life were normal. That, of course, window was slammed shut by the Bush administration. There was a wonderful cultural continuum going on that was just cut off. We haven't had any Cuban musicians play here since 2003, and we're not gonna.
And you yourself have been unable to get there.
I haven't been to Cuba since 2003 myself. I would like to go back for several reasons it hasn't been possible, but one of the main ones is that the United States government makes it so very difficult now and harasses even legal travelers.
Yeah, what do they do exactly?
Well, number one, they've just put all these restrictions on what you can do. They cut off a lot of allowable kinds of travel. There was an innovation of the late Clinton era called people-to-people travel. I was actually taking groups on Afro-Cuban cultural tours, well, up through 2003, when people-to-people licenses were still going on. They had the regs on going to Cuba have changed frequently. They blow with the political winds. And at one time, almost nobody was going to Cuba. And then people started to find legal ways to do it. By the late Clinton administration, they had come up with these blanket licenses where cultural organizations could take people under certain conditions on something kind of like tourism, but it had to have an educational point to it. You couldn't take people to go lie on the beach, but you could take people to go on a tour of Cuban architecture, for example. In practice, those tours were often a lot of fun, but all the tours I ran took the educational mandate very seriously, and there was a lot of education going on. And for me, those tours were fantastic, even as group leader, because I was able to use them as probing tools and do things that I had never been able to accomplish on my own, to go look for things that I'd always said I wanted to try and find, visit some of the smaller towns. That's how I saw a ganga group in the town of Perico. I didn't know there was still a ganga group in existence. Ganga is a group of... from a region of Africa that is now Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, that area. And, you know, they are historically part of the African influence in Cuba, but I didn't think there was still a ganga group in existence, but there is, and I saw it with my own eyes and heard them play the drums which I'd never otherwise seen in Cuba in March 2003. Meanwhile, with all of this contact cut off, and not only musicians aren't allowed to come in, scholars aren't allowed to come in. It's become a routine, you know, every year ritual for the Latin American Studies Association, LASA, that Cuban scholars apply to come in and their visas are denied. So what's happening is that at some future point, when we want to reestablish some basic kinds of relations, we won't have any knowledge. We're cutting off we're starving our scholars, and we depend on scholars. Scholars have a real role to play in our culture. Scholars are very important people because somebody's got to know what's going on.
The Bush administration doesn't like that.
Well, they do. No, the right is very dependent on scholars, but they want to control the scholarship. They want to say who the scholars are. They want to run the think tanks. Repress scholars with whom they do not agree. So part of what this is about, what the travel ban on Cuba has always been about is controlling the image of Cuba in this country. As long as you couldn't travel there and see it for your own eyes, the image of Cuba was reduced to one easily demonizable image, that of the head of state. That's the only Cuban Americans knew, pretty much, when I first went to Cuba in 1990. But as musicians start to come in, when you start to think of Cuba and you think not only of the bearded one, but of Los Muñequitos de Matanzas, or Los Bamban, or Carlos Varela, or Pedro Luis Ferrer, or Compay Segundo, Omar Portuondo, Ibrahim Ferrer, all those people of the Buena Vista Social Club, and you start to have a more human take on who the Cuban people are, it's a lot harder to want to starve them, which is what American law intends to do.
And that's the first part of an interview with the musician and music historian Ned Sublett. I've asked him to bring along some of his favorite music, and I'll let him do the introductions. Here's the first, two more to come later in the program.
I have a new album here by Pedro Luis Ferrer. He's one of the greatest guaracheros in Cuba. He's by no means an officialist performer. He's had a fair amount of controversy in Cuba. This song is called Repetition. Repeticiones. It says, Repetiendo la fórmula vieja sin cesar, con la vieja esperanza de un mundo de igualdad. Viejamente la pose con sed de dignidad. Niño, joven, adulto y anciano, sociedad. Which I'll translate on the fly. Repeating the old formula ceaselessly, with the old hope of a world of equality. Oldly the pose with the thirst of dignity. Child, youth, adult, old person. Society, repeating the repetitions that they will give me, that repeat what has been repeated without doubt. Don't argue, don't think, don't try to disagree. Oldly, the old mills of unity. You can see this is very contrary to what we hear is being said in Cuba. We've just been cut off from what people are doing and saying, and that's why it's so important that we have these records at least.
Otro bien, otro mal, otra forma de estar.
Repeticiones, performed by Pablo Luis Ferrer from the album Natural. Let's take a break for station ID.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
We're back. This is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Before we get back to our interview with Ned Sublett, another musical selection, again introduced by Ned.
This is called Hush, and it's an attempt to adapt what used to be called, and still in Cuba is called, a Negro spiritual to the style of rumba. But what's interesting about it, of course, is that it might very well be, there might very well be a certain historical accuracy to it when you think of those late-day clandestine shipments of Africans being sent from Havana to Louisiana.
That was Hush, performed by Levan Humberto Izquierdo, also known as Cuero, the Spanish word for leather or skin, as in skins of a drum. And now let's get back to my interview with Ned Sublett. He spent some time living in New Orleans and got interested in that city.
Well, I had the good fortune to get a chair at Tulane. I was a Tulane Rockefeller Humanities Fellow. So my wife and I moved down there for the year of 2004-2005, the academic year. And I spent the year on the Tulane campus with an office in the Howard Tilton Library with responsibility of studying history and digging in the libraries and archives, which I did, and studied the culture in the street. I have to say it was a life-changing experience. I had no idea, of course, that I was studying the city in the last year of its life, as it was, because whatever's coming back, it's something very different. I'm still working my way through that one. On August 26th, when the clock stopped, I was 102,000 words into a book about my year in New Orleans. And, of course, then the floodwaters poured through not only the city, but through my book. So I started it over. I compared it to rebuilding a house using the same bricks you had. But I had to rebuild the house. And I'm still working on hoping to finish this book by the end of summer. It'll be called The Year Before the Flood, Music, Murder, and the Legacy of Slavery in New Orleans.
What precisely was life-changing? What did you discover there that changed you?
It's hard to sum up, but I would have to say that the real moment happened precisely when I least expected it to, on Mardi Gras Day. Now, I had thought that Mardi Gras, like a lot of people who aren't New Orleanians, I had thought Mardi Gras was going to be basically bull. You know, I just thought it was going to be a big spree. And, you know. And I really didn't expect to have a spiritual experience on Mardi Gras. But I did. Precisely in the Treme, the oldest African-American residential neighborhood in the United States, in front of the Backstreet Cultural Museum, when I saw an encounter between two Mardi Gras Indian chiefs. And I saw what the Mardi Gras Indians are about, not on a stage, but in the street, really doing it. And that was just a moment of concrete perception of things that I had previously only understood through reading. Now, I had had experiences like this before, but I'd had them in Cuba. What I saw when I saw Mardi Gras Indians in action was very much like the kinds of spiritual experiences I'd had in Cuba.
What do you mean?
Mardi Gras Indians go back, you know, African-American culture took a very different route than it took in the Antilles. The British, of course, prohibited the languages, prohibited the drums, and prohibited the religions. In Cuba, these were all maintained. In Cuba, slaves were constantly being imported from Africa. For over 350 years, there was always freshly arriving Africans. In the United States, Africans came in for a relatively short period of time, and the numbers increased domestically through what some people call the interstate slave trade, but which I prefer to call the slave breeding industry, because the plantations of the Deep South were by and large not worked by people from Africa, but by people from Virginia or Maryland who had been sold down south and their descendants, so that a half million Africans brought to North America became 4 million slaves by the beginning of the Civil War. So African-American culture took a very different path than, say, Afro-Cuban culture. And there really is nothing comparable to what the Mardi Gras Indians do. The Indians' tradition stresses the continuity with Congo Square. As you probably know, Congo Square in New Orleans was the one place in the United States where enslaved people could gather unsupervised and play ancestral drums on Sundays in the years up to the Civil War. There are various travelers' accounts of seeing several hundred black people in these, in what is called Congo Square, this area outside the old city. It's now called Louis Armstrong Park, where there were, one traveler mentioned seeing 20 circles of people singing in their language, in the language of their country. So there's something in New Orleans, which was also, of course, the largest urban black area in the United States, something that didn't exist anywhere else. The Mardi Gras Indian tradition stresses the continuity with Congo Square. If there is no documentation of this, and the origins of, there are various accounts of the various versions of the origins of the Mardi Gras Indians, which, you know, I don't think anyone really has any documentation. But the Indians' tradition itself stresses the connection to Congo Square. And if the tambourines of the Mardi Gras Indians are, in fact, descended from the drumming at Congo Square, which I think in some sense they are, then they are possibly the only direct link with the African hand drumming tradition that we have in this country. Except for possibly Hambone or something, but I'm talking about on some kind of actual drum, if you consider the tambourine a drum. Then there's the second line. The second line is, if you've never been on a second line, there's something about jazz you don't know. Jazz grew out of those second lines, those enormous parades. And to call it a parade suggests a procession with people standing on the sidelines watching, but really a second line picks up people as it goes along, almost more like a conga in Cuba. And, you may have 2,000 people romping down the street, dancing their way down the street for 4 hours on a Sunday afternoon. There were 40-some groups in New Orleans that had second lines. So almost any Sunday, you might very well have a chance of finding one somewhere. 4-hour parades in which there was a kind of collective memory. That's how I looked at it anyway, that, when the people would get together in a mass and do it together, there was a kind of a group knowledge being generated there that was larger than the knowledge of any individual person. And that was badly damaged by the failure of the levees and the flooding of the city and the dispersal of the people. This dispersal of black New Orleanians to the four corners of the earth, or of the country anyway, one of the most shameful incidents in American history.
Can it recover?
I don't know. The good news, if there is good news, is that the bearers of tradition who are there are representing 200%. There are people there who are doing social aid and pleasure clubs. The second lines are going, I went to Mardi Gras this year to see the Indians represent. And they were definitely there, and they were definitely representing. I mean, they're the soul of the town. So really, there's a lot of weight on their shoulders. It was vital importance that they managed to mask Indian this year, and vital importance that they managed to continue to have second lines. It's hard to say what will happen. There's a lot of reason to wonder, but there's also a lot of determination to make it happen.
On the other hand, the business elite is looking to make it a whiter, richer city when it's rebuilt. Are they going to get their way?
There has been no secret made of that, that a lot of people would like to see a smaller New Orleans, which is a code word for a less black New Orleans. And there are certainly a lot of obstacles right now that are keeping people from returning. You know, I have no crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that the people of that town were very deeply rooted. It's almost a paradox, you know. The people that New Orleans was not a destination for immigration in the second half of the 20th century. People didn't move into New Orleans. They moved out. And the people who were in New Orleans were people, many of them, you know, had been there for three generations or more. The place with the shakiest ground had the most deeply rooted people.
It was a little bit of a surprise to see Roy Nagin win re-election as mayor. What do you make of that?
Roy Nagin. Well, you know, there were only two candidates in the runoff, and people chose. Certainly looks to me like people, you know, 80% of the black vote went for Nagin and 80% of the white vote went for Landrieu. 80% of the black vote went for the black candidate, 80% of the white vote went for the white candidate. Of course, there weren't supposed to be as many black people voting as voted. But black people were some 55% of the vote cast, and people went through enormous difficulties to be able to vote. I mean, people who came in from out of state, because, you know, people are planning to come back, but it's a multi-year thing, you know, to be able to do that. They can't just pick up and get back there. They don't have the resources. Their houses are in ruins, da-da-da-da. So it's going to, you know, take people 2-3 years to get back there. Meanwhile, if they are to continue being citizens of that town, they need to express themselves through being enfranchised. So it was a very, very crucial thing. A lot of people couldn't manage to get back to vote, but there were people who came in from out of state for the primary and then again for the runoff, just to be able to vote. If you find that voting is an inspiring demonstration of what our American democracy is about, you really have to take your hat off to the people of New Orleans who made those personal sacrifices in order to pay that exorbitant poll tax of getting back to be able to vote.
I'm speaking with Ned Sublett, the musician and scholar of music. Time for another musical selection, and again, I'll let him do the intro. Bring any New Orleans music with you?
Yeah, not what we were talking about just now, but I have one album with me that I really love. It's an album almost nobody's heard. It's an album made in 1994 by Coco Robichaud. Coco Robichaud, you can still hear him every Saturday night on Frenchman Street, New Orleans at the Apple Barrel. He was one of the first person to play in New Orleans after the electricity came on after the flood. He's a Choctaw Cajun from Ascension Parish, Louisiana. This tune is called Walking with the Spirit, and it really got me through some of the tough days of September. I put this on in the morning to give myself the heart to move along with the day.
Sometimes I walk all by myself. I don't want to talk to no one else. And I close my eyes and I feel the spirit rise. And it feels so good to me. I can tell I'm supposed to be. Yeah.
just call its name. It's gonna set your soul aflame. Oh, yeah. And then you'll burn with the power of love. And you'll turn to your light up above. And you'll feel brand new when the spirit comes to carry you. Oh, yeah. I can see you now.
Walking with the Spirit by Coco Robichaud. And now, the final part of my interview with Ned Sublett. Let's close by talking a little bit about music and politics. So,
sure.
A lot of what you've been analyzing music politically, as you've been talking about it throughout this interview, a lot of that, when people listen to music, they often don't hear that or don't know about that. It's as if politics and culture exist in separate worlds, in at least in the mainstream. What do you think of that?
And even on the left, there's this idea that there's something called political music, which consists of having sloganeering lyrics. In Spanish, there's a wonderful word for that, panfletismo, pamphletism. One of the interesting things about the Cuban, I learned a lot in Cuba. I learned a lot about music. I learned a lot about life. I learned a lot about society by being in a place where things that have all my life obtained no longer obtain. Where you can't just go to a store and get something, for example. But in Cuba, you know, there's a lot of things you can't just come out and say. And what's so interesting about the Cuban songwriters is they don't sloganeer, for the most part. I mean, there are some who do, but there are really very few. Cuban songwriters are good at asking questions. They ask interesting questions and count on the engagement of the people with the music to provide the answers. I say that in Cuba, a coro, you know, the coro is the thing that repeats, that the chorus singers repeat while the lead singer improvises, and the coro is really what in our music we would call the hook a lot of the time. And the coro very often doesn't acquire its meaning until the people have sung it for months and months and kind of put their own meaning on it. I remember this wonderful tune Van Van had about 10 years ago called Voy a publicar tu foto en la prensa, which is the story of the song is a guy's girl has dumped him and he's going to tell everyone what she did to him, and it says, Voy a publicar tu foto en la prensa. I'm going to publish your picture in the paper. You know, I'm going to publish your picture in the press. This is in a country that who you can't start your own newspaper. You know, there's only one press in Cuba, right? So what does it mean to have 5,000 people singing, Voy a publicar tu foto en la prensa? You know, it's a question. All the artists I know are doing music that has some kind of implied political edge to it, pretty much. And that's been true pretty much all along. But we've gotten so used to the idea, even ourselves as artists, that we're just implying it rather than saying it, that I think it often passes unnoticed. This, I mean, you know, the very issue of what salsa is and how it fits into our culture is political, whether the lyrics are about love or about society. There's still almost an implicit politics to the existence of the music.
And that was the voice of Ned Sublett, the musician and scholar of music history. Ned will be reading from his book In Progress About Louisiana, along with four other writers at the BOM All-Star Reading Series at The Kitchen, 512 West 19th Street, on June 14th at 7 p.m., and he'll be playing a solo acoustic gig at the Bowery Poetry Club, Bowery and Bleecker, Wednesday, June 28th at 8 p.m. sharp. And let's go out with this splendid recording by Willie Nelson of a song that Ned Sublett wrote in 1981, inspired by the Christopher Street bar named Boots and Saddles. Ned said Willie's been a fan of the song since 1988, when Tony Garnier, who played on Sublett's recording of it, slipped Nelson a copy of Ned's never-released cassette to Willie one night when Tony was playing on the Saturday Night Live band and Willie was the musical guest. Willie Nelson doing Ned Sublett's Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other. Till next week, this is Doug Henwood. Bye.
Out on the plains of West Texas, there's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend. And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between the sexes. Oh, a small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men. And I believe to my soul that inside every man there's the feminine. And inside every lady there's a deep, manly voice, loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he's done with his women, but the ones who brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer. Cowboys frequently, secretly fond of each other. Say, what did you think all them saddles and boots was about? And there's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels for his brother. And inside every cowboy there's a lady that loves to slip out. Inside every cowboy, there's a lady that'd love to slip out.